His skin is white just like a ghost. Thick Irish roots and his blonde hair. And he sounds like a Chicago super fan. A music nerd with a collection of CDs from here to there. Yes, Andy Dare is in Chicago, interviewing and barbecuing. It's the Andy Dare Show. It's the Andy Dare Show.
Welcome to the Andy Dare Show. I'm your host, Andy. Today it is episode 164, and I'm joined by Eric Matthews and Jordan Zadarazny. And yes, they have a new album, Baron of the Fjord, and it is credited to the band Shilum. And it's Eric Matthews, Jordan Zadarazny, and Filippo Gaetani. They traded files across the country and to Italy as well. So this is definitely an interesting album. Check it out. Full of layers, production vibes. They trade off instruments and vocals. It's just a really interesting sounding album. And Eric is new to the group, but Jordan and Filippo had been working previously. A few years ago, they met during recording sessions for Ken Andrews' Digital Noise Academy. So, yeah, they sparked a friendship, and they're still working together as we speak. And, yeah, definitely one of the strongest albums I've heard so far in 2016. And it's an interesting chat. I've got Jordan calling in from Ontario, and Eric Matthews calling in from Oregon. So this is just it's an interesting world we live in 2016, when you can record an album, in two completely different areas, or three different areas, and even on different continents, and then also do a podcast the same way. Thank you, technology. So this is a cool chat. Stay tuned. And also in other news, I just want to wish a happy 40th birthday to Jesse Anderson. And yes, I'm so grateful to have him on our little podcast network, Jesse Unplugged. And check out the show. We do a monthly show. Jesse's a real interesting guy. Spent time in the whole world of wrestling. Spent time working with bands. His brother is Billy Corgan, Smashing Pumpkins, and he just got an awesome original story, and he's a nice guy, and I just want to thank him so much for being part of our network, and happy 40th birthday, dude. All right, so I'm going to keep my spiel short this week. I am going to introduce you to my episode 146, Adapt and Evolve, with special guests Eric Matthews and Jordan Zadarazny. Everybody, thank you so much for checking out the Andy Dare Show. Today it is episode 164, and this is a cool first-time thing for me. I'm having two guests. They're both from the band Shilum, and it is Eric Matthews, and later we'll be joined by Jordan Zadarazny. How you doing, Eric?
I'm very well this morning, man. Thanks for calling and putting this together, and let's see how this experience of yours works with the three-way call.
Sure, yeah, I mean... The Shilum album is pretty, it sounds like that took hours and hours of work, and I heard you guys did it by sending files across from Canada, from Oregon, and Italy, correct?
That's true. It was a lot of data push back and forth, across continent and internationally, and yeah, it was a long process. They started the record a year before I even got in, and... the truth of it is everybody's got other things going on.
Sure.
And although this is a high priority project for all of us, certainly it was something that we sort of have to fit in around our other, duties professionally. So, yeah, we took the time, and I think that probably shows in the end product.
Yeah, I mean, it definitely does not sound like a side project. It sounds like something that... has been years in the making. So this is the second album from Shilum. How about the name Shilum? What is that from?
Well, that's, that's easier for Filippo to explain.
Gotcha.
I've asked on a couple of occasions, and I am yet sort of to gain any more understanding than at this point than when I first asked. a couple of years ago.
Nice. And yeah, I just watched the new video, America on Fire. Really cool visual effects on that thing. Great song. Does the title have any reference to this crazy political climate we're in 2016?
Not really. That song and that lyric, which was written by Filippo, was and by the way, he's going to bust me because I don't say his name right. But anyway, no, it doesn't. As a matter of fact, that lyric dates back now probably almost 2 years, so all this candidacy stuff. He's got a great explanation about the song, but it does indeed. There's sort of the well-acknowledged sort of European and sort of world perspective on, you know, what it's like here in America. Our gun violence situation.
Sure.
Crime and so some of these things, as seen through the perspective of the people around the world, it's a different one than, you know, those of us living in America who, you know, we live, most all of us, ordinary, beautiful, bucolic lives.
Sure, yeah, he's away from it, so he can take a different, a view of it. Very cool.
And he's not naive. He spends time in America. He knows the vast nature of it, you know. And so it's not some sort of condemnation by any means. But, you know, listen, any given day you could wake up, let's say, on 9/11 in 2001, and, it's the world is full of hotspots, and sure. America is not immune to being one of them.
And Europe isn't either, obviously, with the Paris stuff that happened late last year. So.
Yeah.
So no, we're all feeling it.
It's on the spread. There's a heavy grip of evil and sort of ancient forces, you know, that want to try to put an end to the party. You know, what is the 21st century? Where, you know, anyway.
I don't get it. Yeah, that's why we stick to the music, the creativity. It's a positive thing, and yeah, this album.
But your question is a good one in that it's kind of impossible in certain times for the two not to cross some. You know,
of course, yeah.
Art is always affected, of course, by sort of what's going on in the world.
And every once in a while, what's going on in the world is reflected from art too. So it goes both ways. A cool thing about this album, it seems like you guys share duties on every instrument, something that is very rare in music. You're playing drums on one track, you're writing and singing on another. You know, Jordan's doing the same thing, Filippo's doing the same thing.
Yeah, we all play lots of guitars, and, you know, it's all, yeah.
I was trying to think of another band that does that, where the roles are kind of blurry.
Yeah. Good question. You're like rock trivia.
nice. I mean, the Beach Boys, the Wrecking Crew, a lot of stuff like
that. Yeah. I mean, listen, you can point to the Beatles, certainly, all the principals play piano and guitar and, you know, lead vocal, and, you know, Paul would play drums from time to time. So, I mean, there's some of that for sure. I would think of Steely Dan, but then that's Donald Fagen is mostly at the piano.
And more session musicians and stuff like that. You guys didn't use any session musicians. It's just the three of you?
Well, no, there are a couple of brief guest starring appearances. As a matter of fact, maybe just one. No, I feel irresponsible for not looking more closely at the credits. No, we've got a saxophone player.
Oh, okay.
I do not play saxophone.
I wanted to take it back. You are just celebrating like a 20th anniversary of your debut album, your debut solo album. How was it being on the Sub Pop roster, post Cobain's death, all that stuff, and kind of sticking out like a sore thumb in that you didn't really reflect the Mudhoney, Screaming Trees, Soundgarden sound. You had an ornate pop, a lush production on the album that recalled more like Scott Walker or something like that. Was it hard fitting in with that crew?
Well, we were not, perhaps luckily, I don't know, unluckily, there wasn't a lot of opportunity for, say, social mixing. It wasn't, I met some of the other bands, and I knew some of the other bands even going in. Sabado was on the label at the time. But, you know, you're pointing to, you're right, the sort of core culture at that label at the time was sort of a punk rock garage band aesthetic, the, you know, the, somebody cooked up the word grunge at some point.
DIY, but, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I grew up with a lot of those types of guys and bands in the Portland area that it was all rough and tumble, rock and roll, no frills. Nobody was thinking about putting trumpets and strings on songs. But, you know, people do seem to forget on the Sub Pop label, I wasn't the sort of standout. Perhaps certainly the way I did it on my records was different, but, you know, the label had Zompano, which is one of my favorite, a band from Canada. They were making some very sort of complicated pop music that was, that did contain, you know, moments of brass and strings. And Jeremy Enoch, you know, fresh off his, he was starting his solo era as well,
sure,
at the same time, 96, you know, coming out of Sunny Day Real Estate. And, I mean, his album was more orchestral than mine. Mine was more, my first two albums there were probably more rock-oriented than his. So
sure. Okay.
It's a funny thing. I think that Sub Pop was getting pretty experimental. They had some soul. They had a soul act, a black girl singer, Thornetta Davis, I want to say. You know, they started straying into that. I can't speak French, but Saint Etienne or whatever.
Oh, sure, Saint Etienne.
They were branching out.
Yeah, sure. And like around that same time, the whole Britpop invasion across the pond seemed more up your style, like Blur playing with a huge orchestra for the Universal, stuff like that. Oasis,
or even a band like Oasis, who was returning to a more heavily melodic and
big sound,
you know, sort of a big sound, but really a 60s sensibility, which is, you know, something that's part of all us guys who were born in the mid to late 60s, who were sort of the prominent musicians of that, you know, the mid 90s, early 90s, we all grew up with our parents' record collections, which there's a lot of the similarities there, you know, Beatles, Bee Gees, Beach Boys, Bacharach. So you had a slew of acts come out there in the early and mid 90s where, yeah, we were all heavily motivated and touched by the 60s.
Nice.
and 70s music.
Did you tour across the pond? Did you go to Europe and England and all that? Or?
Well, not in the ordinary sense. I never had, never is not the right word, but I never had a band, you know, an act.
Gotcha.
That, you know, much like Shalom, it was about sitting in the studio and putting together songs as, you know, craftily as I could.
Nice.
And that never did translate. I did have a band for a short period, but it was very unsatisfying. It was really five guys, and we didn't have any sort of budget for a string orchestra
sure.
or anything. So it was rough. I did go overseas, you know, some of the normal, you know, France and England, Belgium. And those are promotional tours. I did, you know, radio shows and TV spots.
Cool.
And just, you know, that kind of thing.
Was there
any
pressure on you from Sub Pop to get on MTV to do any of that stuff, or are they pretty much give you free rein to do what you will in the recording studio?
Well, we went in with a pretty clear understanding of what I wanted my role to be there, and that was as a creator, as the sort of Brian Wilson after all the world tours, but without having had the world tours.
Sure.
So, yeah. They certainly were very encouraging when every opportunity would come up to point out that, hey, you know, if you do these, we'll set up these dates in the city, and, you know, it's really the benefit campaign. And I would consider each of the situations and try to. A couple of times it came close where we were probably close to going into sort of a pre-production mode on making some plans and getting some guys together and hiring some help. But it's just really at no real point did that look feasible to me or artistically sort of viable.
Nice, but I did see that they got you in magazines quite a bit. I would always see the names, I'd read the reviews, and that's pretty much what turned me on 20 years ago was reading about you guys. So.
Well, thank God. Here's the thing: Sub Pop at the time was very, very organized, and it was a different world than it is now. I mean, I don't know how they launch acts now. I mean, you can't get on commercial radio like. I got on commercial radio in 1995. You know, we had a great publicity and marketing department and radio department, and it was a heavily funded staff. you know, they were into that Warner Music
sure.
money.
Okay.
You know, and so it was so that's why guys like you and you know, so many people know about my albums, because, you know, I was plugged into the fashion, you know, big machine system.
Sure. Yeah. It seems like Sub Pop is still doing that even in 2016, because you'll go to a Target and you'll see a Slater Kinney album, and then you'll turn over the record and it says Sub Pop on it, and you go, wow, okay, they're still, you know, contending.
Yeah,
they're getting their music out there.
Yeah, you're speaking to the distribution end there, which they're still, of course, well aligned with the old machine. But, you know, can they get a new band? They have bands that sell.
Yeah.
700,000 copies, but you don't hear them on the radio, you know, in sure. the same lineup. And that's the amazing thing. Looking back, you know, where you'd sit in your car and you'd hear Radiohead, and then Oasis, and then Eric Matthews. And then, you know, so that I guess now you look back and it was a rare and blessed thing that, you know, an artist of my caliber or just stature, low stature, frankly, you know, was... We had access, you know, to the big time radio, and so that's a sad thing, and you know, something that Sub Pop laments now, that they don't have that
sure.
hook in, you know, because they've got some big acts, you know, some borderline household name, you know, high end indie rock and you know, rock acts.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it sucks. I mean, they can't get on radio.
Well, it all changed around the turn of the millennium, it seemed like, and you definitely felt that, and you took a bunch of time off in between the second album and the third album, right?
Well, I didn't take time off. I was uninvited to the party. What happened, and I explained this in an interview the other day, funny enough, a lot changed there in the late 90s. Going into the 2000, the industry more or less collapsed.
Yeah.
You know, radio stations closed, studios closed, labels were running out of business. I lost my deal at Sub Pop in, I was released in 99, or was it 98, late 98, early 99. And, you know, one might presume, like you did, I tipped time off. It wasn't that. It's that the labels were closing everywhere, you know. And as hard as I tried and sent around, because people would ask, you know, I was still... I was doing lots of side work at the time, you know, Tahiti 80 and Ivy and Dandy Warhols.
Nice, okay.
And so nobody, I didn't die in a car crash, they knew. So people were asking, well, is there going to be another album, you know, from Eric Matthews? And you know.
You're waiting
I was
for the right getting, situation, right?
Yeah. I was getting very close several times to having, you know, good deals here and there. And then, bam, label closed. You know, it was...
Well, it's
collapsing.
It's a weird gray area between where the labels are collapsing, but you can't really do it yourself. It's not really the social media era it is now, where you can just buy a website, put your music up, and then self-promote. It was in between those two eras, and that must have been a tough time
yeah,
for most musicians.
Right. Right. Well, no, we had the internet, but it's definitely pre-social media, pre-bandcamp, pre-all the stuff that's going on now, where bands can sort of self-release.
Sure.
Funny enough, I'm still stuck in the old days. I get bugged every day. Where's your next album, Eric? Because I'm again in one of these droughts, right? And it's the same old thing. I don't have a label right now putting me out. Now, I'm in talks right now with a couple of labels
nice.
On a next album that I've had finished since 2010.
Oh,
but,
okay.
So I'm not, I don't have that DIY spirit. I would probably just rather disappear than be, you know, licking envelopes and putting stamps on packages. I cannot do that. I will not do that. I'm spoiled. I come from the old days. I had it too good, too soft for too long. I'm not willing to make, or I'm not able to make that adjustment.
Nice. Yeah, you don't want to be your own manager like every band coming up is now, where
yeah.
they're shameless self-promoting all the time. And
yeah, well, shameless. Listen, if you got something you believe in, that you want the world to hear, the 900 people who might go out and seek out your music, then yeah, bang your head on the rocks and go for it. And I think that's awesome. And I, you know, obviously there aren't really any other alternate paths for most new acts, young guys, you know, coming up. And so that's, and they don't know anything different, but it's hard for a guy who was once handed, you know, routinely, you know, $80,000 and $100,000 at a time to make an album. Mm-hmm. And then all you do is sit back and watch the various departments do their job at the label. You know, it's hard. It's hard It's just hard to make that adjustment, and I don't know how people do it. I haven't figured that out yet.
And it's weird when the old guard isn't. We're not talking about 1972. We're talking about 95, 97 too. It's not even 20 years old, and it's still. I guess that was a totally different climate, and you had it made, and so it's tough to reacclimate yourself to the new world, right?
Yep. It is. It sounds like I'm complaining or something, and I'm not. Truth is, I've always found a way to sort of keep my hand in the game, keep my name in the papers, just through working with other people and stuff, even if I don't have a fresh album. And thank God, you know, Shalom, great example. We're talking about Shalom. You know, Shalom is a great outlet for me because it's another opportunity for me to do something very creative that is getting out to people and even utilizing some of these new methods of distribution and stuff. But, you know, my band Cardinal has, you know, that has kept me busy. We had an album now, 4 years ago, that Hymns album, the follow-up that took 18 years to make. And then I had this other group, Sinking Ships. And that was you know, I had a deal there for a couple of years on a Sony imprint called S Curve. So, you know, that it's all, I keep going, you know what I mean? And I have three albums that are in the can, ready for release, essentially. Oh. So, you know, it's just a matter. It'll happen any day now, or any month now, any year now, let's be honest, where I'm going to have another deal, and you'll get three Eric Matthews albums in a four-year period.
That will be awesome. I can't wait.
Yeah.
A million different irons in the fire. How about we take a break, and we'll be right back, and we'll bring Jordan in on the conversation.
Awesome.
Cool.
Hey, yo. Jay Pawks here. I know you're keeping a lock to the Dara Network for all your podcast needs, whether that's the Andy Dara Show, the Tyler Kale Show, Jesse Unplugged, or the smooth, sultry tones of me, the Jay Pawks Podcast. You keep it locked to AndyDara.com all throughout 2016 for all the luscious podcast action.
It's the future. All right, 6-1.
Crystal clear.
Hello?
Hey, Jordan.
Hey.
Jordan.
How you doing?
Hey, can you hear me? Good. Can you hear me all right?
Are you in a huge mansion or something? Or let's see. You got a...
He's at Mar-a-Lago with Melania.
Are you in a cathedral?
No, does it sound big and boomy or something?
You're in a reverb tank.
Weird. Let me move over to another room and you tell me if it's any better.
Okay.
So I'm going to reboot the tank here. Let's see.
It could be a function of this three-way thing.
How's this?
Let's hear you. Hello?
How's it now? Any better?
I think it's better, yeah. Let's hear you.
That's a little better, yeah.
Yeah.
It sound, you know what it sounds
there's
almost like to? Is it, Jordan, is it a cell phone?
It is, yeah.
Okay. That's probably the difference.
It's cool. It sounds good.
Yeah,
enough.
No, yeah. I can understand.
Yeah. All right, so we did...
Great. Hey, Eric.
Yep.
Well, hey, Jordan, how are you doing, man?
I'm doing great, thank you.
Should we spill the beans?
Which beans?
Well, you know, the beans regarding this phone call.
Oh, that we've never spoken before?
Yes. I think that's a hot news item for this interview.
Nice.
Andrew's taken aback. He's like, wait, I've been listening to this album for the last few months. What the hell?
Am I a matchmaker here? Nice.
Exactly.
Bringing people together, the Andy Dare Show since 2011. Let's do it. Nice.
Yes.
Okay, so it's Jordan Zatarazny. Is that how you pronounce it? I want to make sure I got it right.
Yeah, pretty close. Zatarazny.
Zatarazny. Okay, cool.
Or Zaporozhny, as I've been corrected by one Ukrainian national.
Nice. Well, yeah, we just did about 15 to 20 minutes with Eric. We thought we'd bring Jordan in. The new Shalom album, Baron of the Fjord, is out now, shalom.com. You can go to shalom.bandcamp.com. It is a great listen. How was the recording of this thing, Jordan?
Well, it was over a pretty long period of time, and you know, we had a lot of time to consider, you know, kind of every move we made with this thing. So I don't know. I think we boiled it down to a nice roux or something. I don't know.
So there was nobody like sticking you to a time schedule. You guys got to do this at your leisurely pace, which is a good thing for creativity, right?
Yeah, there was no you know, no label or anything involved. We did this all on our own, and we all have lives, so it took a while, but I think it was worth it.
Nice, and it's a very ornamental sound. It's got a lot of different layers. It's definitely not just three guys in a room. It's a million different things going on at once, which is cool in this climate. How would you expect this? Would you ever be able to play these things live, or is it just everybody's doing everything at once, so it's kind of more of just a studio, something cooked up in the studio?
You know, if someone gave us $100,000 to put together a show at the Hollywood Bowl, I think we'd all be there.
Nice.
But, you know, the thought of actually trying to pull this off in any sort of, you know, rock and roll context would seem kind of pointless or really, really difficult. And Eric and I don't like touring anyway, so.
I don't think anybody does. Unless you're 17 or 18, I don't think anybody really loves hitting the road. I think that's just something cooked up by Cameron Crowe, right? Am I wrong?
Well, I know.
Well, there was budgets back then.
Yeah, I know plenty of the both categories. I know guys who are my age, Jordan's age, who are enthusiastic about going out. It blows my mind, the guys, the friends of mine in Sebado. They tour. They're playing constantly, and then Lewis is also in Dinosaur Jr. and he seems to love it. And I think he should get his head checked.
It's weird. He was my last guest. He's my last guest on the show, Lou Barlow. So that's cool. I had no idea that you guys had worked together as the Belt Buckles for like a single or something like that.
Well, yeah, it's a little EP. Nobody should know about that, but
nice.
It's still a fun little. Yeah. Those are my one and only what you could call sort of rock and roll, blue jeans.
Nice.
Yeah.
What does that thing fetch a high price on eBay?
Yeah. Listen, it was fairly limited. I think there were three pressings, and there's probably 3,000 of them floating around. So.
Nice.
Yeah. I like that it's rare. Put it that way.
Very cool. But Jordan, you obviously got your own story. Blinker the Star since, 1993 or 4 even? And you just released an EP.
Yeah, yeah.
And you just put out a new EP. It's very awesome. Is this a teaser for a full length coming up soon? Or?
Well, it's kind of just going to be a standalone thing. And but I will do another full length. Another Blink of the Star full length. It's not going to sound like that one at all. I'm kind of starting fresh, so
nice.
Sometime later in the year, I think.
I always would hate it when a band would put out an EP and then they would follow it up with the full length, and you already have six of the 11 songs. It kind of seems like it's a little bit of a hollow victory, you know?
Yeah, no, these songs won't appear anywhere else.
Very cool.
If I can jump in, a great example of that, though, where it worked. A pretty unique situation was the band The Clientele from London. They're from England. I can't remember where they're from, but they did the cool thing. Their debut album was a collection of 7-inches. They had put over a period of 2 years. Alistair was writing me as a 19-year-old fan letters for Cardinal.
Oh, nice.
Well, it's heavy in here. And he was sending me these singles, like, hey, check out my band. And I didn't really get it. It was very sort of sloppy's not the right word, but it was very relaxed, put it this way. I liked the music. I thought the songs were great. But then when that compiled, they put all those singles together onto an LP. I thought it was amazing.
Nice.
And of course, it was those singles were so limited that it really does play like a fresh album.
It definitely worked with the Beta Band in like 1998 when they started. They had the three EPs, which we could never find stateside for anything reasonable price. So when they all came out together, it was like just one nice long statement. It was good
right.
that way. But yeah, I talked with Eric previously about his time on the Sub Pop roster. Jordan, you did your time with DreamWorks, which is really just a boutique label for Geffen. Am I right?
Well, they had some pretty lofty ideals, and they had a lot of money from a Japanese grocer, as I understand. So they kind of, the other labels in town used to call them the Arts and Crafts Show derisively, because they were really sinking a lot of money into, you know, what I consider some really good acts, but it couldn't last forever. I think the culture of the label changed a little bit once someone kind of had an accidental hit with a rap rock band. And I remember they kind of started to try to sell records to the end, but I think that was pretty close to when all of the labels were kind of really kind of finishing up, you know, in the way things were.
And then I remember Matt Mahaffey.
Only there for one album, actually.
Matt
was a good friend. I saw him a lot. Yeah. I think our albums came out like in the same month.
Nice.
That Breakfast Girls, yeah.
1999, right? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And, it was cool. Like, it just seemed like they had a good taste, and it was not DGC, it was not Geffen, it was something different, and... But you guys felt it just like Sub Pop felt it, just like Eric felt it, the turn of the century with the labels closing. And then as I was talking to Eric, it was a time between where we are now with social media and do it yourself, put it out yourself. You don't need the record label really. But at the same time, all the labels were closing. So that was kind of a bad point, what, year 2000 to 2008, something like that.
I agree. I feel that was an awkward time to release records, really.
Kind of like the Great Depression for alt rock. Yeah.
It was. And here's the good news, though. Guys like Jordan, guys like Jordan with his skill set and, you know, writing chops, though he didn't have access like he did before with, you know, sort of major label level support, was able to go off and do work with other people. You know, he became sort of a support and sort of production / writer guy, you know, for some big acts like with Hole and, you know, some of the Smashing Pumpkins connections he has. In my dark years of not having albums out or a label, you know, I was working a lot in New York with producer Andy Chase and the acts that he was producing, you know, Tahiti 80 and
nice.
His band Ivy and groups from Japan. And so, you know, we were spared in a way, being just, you know, sent off to go get a day job.
Yeah. You find ways to survive. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, and I think that this is an old rule of show business that goes back as far as it goes. If you have skills, if you have chops, and if you still have a desire to work, there's usually some way to keep your hand in it, you know, and these are two guys you're talking to who fall into that category.
Nobody who's truly good is out of work for too long. If you're really good at your craft, you'll find a way to make it happen, right?
Right. I mean, you can't necessarily get rich or sustain some sort of lavish lifestyle, but
as long as you don't have a cocaine habit, you can make it. You can pay the rent, right? Yeah.
Exactly. Just the wine habit, but. Yeah. What do you think about that? That's true, right? In your perspective, Joe?
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, so...
Yeah, there's a few of us out there.
Yeah. I was looking, you know, as you said, with Hole, Celebrity Skin, I thought that was actually her defining moment. Seemed like she would really push herself over as one of the greats of 90s rock. It was polished, but it still had some grit to it. I'm an acquaintance out here with Billy Corgan, too, in Chicago. How was it writing with her for that album, Courtney Love?
Well, it was pretty insane.
Yeah.
I was 23 years old. I was And I guess I was out there for about 7 or 8 weeks. Started off living at the Hyatt, and then I moved up into her house for a couple of weeks. So I kind of thrust right into it.
Nice.
And we would basically just write. We wrote a pile of songs. There was only one that ended up making the record from my contributions. And then, as you know, Billy took over, and yeah, he kind of added some real, you know, pop to it, which was needed, I think.
Sure.
I couldn't really do that very well then. I think I wasn't quite sure what they were going after.
If you got approached to do her new album in 2016, would you think about it?
Yeah, I would think about it. Yeah, I would.
Security,
there'd be...
I mean, I don't think she's ever hit that mark of quality in her work since then, unfortunately, whatever demons she's battling with that. But, yeah, Celebrity Skin is very strong, and it's got that big pop production that was, I guess it's very 1998 sounding, but even Marilyn Manson was doing that.
Michael Beinhorn did that one. Michael Beinhorn. Yeah.
And it's weird.
And he was kind of hot off of a...
It felt like 1994 and 1998 was like a decade away from each other at that point. It was weird. Yeah.
That's true. That's true, yep.
And people were still buying music and supporting artists. And that's when you were on DreamWorks and putting out albums with Blinker the Star. Fast forwarding out to this time, how did Shalom start? I know you got the Filippo, is that how you pronounce it, out in Italy?
Yeah, Filippo. Yeah, Filippo and I met in Los Angeles. We were invited out to this sort of, you know, it's like a loose collection of semi-like-minded musicians put together by Ken Andrews of Failure.
Nice.
And Filippo was part of the early sessions, and the band eventually kind of whittled itself down to 5-6 core members. But Filippo and I continued to work together because we really got along. And some of the songs that were rejected by Digital Noise Academy, we ended up using for the first Shalom album.
Cool.
So that's how we met. And then shortly after that, he came up to my studio in Pembroke, and that's where the actual, you know, nuts and bolts of the first record started.
Awesome.
2007, something like that.
And you run a studio out in Ontario?
I do, yeah.
What's it called?
Skylark Park.
Nice.
Skylark Park Studios. And I'm watching the snow melt today.
Nice.
Oh, beat of it.
I feel like spring is on its way. And, yeah, who you got recording lately in the studio?
I had a band in last week called Dear Black Wolf that are from Ottawa. That was the most recent thing. They came in here and... had their way with the studio, kind of redesigned it, brought in some props, and did some live recording with video.
Okay.
So I think that's coming out this weekend or something. It's kind of cool.
That's awesome. Do you have, like, are you a gearhead? Do you just collect gear, old analog stuff, or is it more of trying to get the new stuff?
I definitely don't go down the rabbit hole to the degree that some people do. I mean, I have pieces of gear that I love and cherish and use every day. But I'm not super. I mean, if you came here, you'd look around and you'd go, "Yeah, this guy's a gearhead." But I don't. I spend more time writing and recording music than attaining or thinking about gear.
Okay, cool. How about this, Jordan? How about your first reaction to hearing Eric Matthews' music? The first time you heard Eric's music, and then we'll ask Eric the first time you heard Jordan's music.
He's
never really
like
heard
it the first time. It took him a while, but I remember it really well. The album CD was on display at Aaron's Records in Hollywood, and we were recording the second Blinker the Star record. And you know, there'd be breaks, and I'd walk over because it was just around the corner, and I would buy, you know, a shit ton of CDs every couple days over there. And Eric's record was up, nice display, really nice write-up from the staff. And I had actually not read any of the press or anything that had been coming out, because I know that there was a lot of it. Once I got it, then there was a lot of press that I'd noticed that was out there already. So the ritual was to just bring these CDs back and have lunch in the studio and then kind of listen to a track or two off of each CD and see if there's anything cool out there. And that one, just kind of blew the socks off of both of us. It was just right up our alley. It was just very influential to me. And then once I moved out there permanently, my whole extended kind of group of musical friends, were really, really into Cardinal and Eric's records as well. So it was really in the air out there at that time.
Very awesome. And Eric, how about your first recollections of Blinker the Star or Jordan in general?
Well, my story isn't quite as sexy or flattering probably, but Jordan and I have a common friend, Spooky Rubin. He's a recording artist out of Toronto. And he and I we became friends in, 1996 or something. His label, TVT, flew him out to a Sub Pop anniversary party where we were put together to talk and meet and blah, blah. Anyway, we got on very quickly together as friends. And over a couple of years, we were working together quite a bit into, 98, 99 on his albums. Just one day, I remember he called me, like, you got to hear this new record, this Blink of the Star that you're on DreamWorks. This is this young guy I know from around here. And he sent me a CD that he burned or something. And he was awaiting my big review. And I was like, there's some good music on it. But, it really just didn't catch me all the way. I liked the voice. I remember saying, wow, this is amazing, these guitars and all this stuff. But there's something about it that just didn't really connect up for me. And you really have to fast forward then several years to when I was gaining contact with the Shalom, that I was able to go back. And everything I was hearing out of Jordan musically on this album, the Shalom album, was stunning. And I was like, well, wait a minute. So I did get a chance to go back and listen to, what's the name of this, the album from 5 years ago? The
Blink. We Draw Lines?
Yeah. Anyway, I'm going back and realizing, of course, that what I missed out on.
Nice.
Yeah.
Very cool. And yeah, I'd like to get Filippo on the call, but I think my computer would explode in my basement here. this has been a delightful chat. Shalom.com, shalom.bandcamp.com. I would highly recommend this new album. I think it stands out like a sore thumb in 2016. I think that's a great thing. Any plans for the new year for you two? Are you working on Blinker and you're working on solo stuff, or what's up for 2016?
Well, for me, you go.
Okay. Well, same as usual here. Definitely working on new Blinker, but also when I write here and record, I don't really have an agenda when I begin a song, and sometimes it. By the time I get sort of half finished, I decide to pass it on to someone else. So I've passed a few to Eric already. So there are some germs of ideas of new Shalom stuff as well. So
awesome. And you, Eric?
Yeah. And yeah, that's one of the things I'm dipping into next. I do have three or four songs that Jordan started, and I don't know where they end up. We tend to, when he sends me something, it's usually a very successful collaboration in what I add, and it turns out to be the germ of a finished song or work. So, I think we can assume that if there's another Shalom album, that you'll be hearing some of this stuff on that. Cool. Like I said, already, I've got sort of finished albums in the works, and I have a couple of label opportunities right now that I'm exploring where we might see a new Eric Matthews released this year. So plenty to keep busy with.
Awesome. Well, I just want to thank you guys for taking the time out. This has been a delightful chat.
Thank you, Aaron.
Yeah, I mean, this would be really hard. This would have been impossible to do in 1995, but in 2016, it's definitely a possibility. And, yes, check out the new Shalom album, Baron of the Fjord, out now, shalom.com. And thanks again. Any last words, guys?
America's on fire.
Nice. On behalf of Eric.
I'll leave it with that. That's great.
On behalf of Eric and Jordan, this is Andy signing off for the Andy Derer Show. This episode of the Andy Derer Show is brought to you in part by Uncle Bub's award-winning barbecue in Westmont, Illinois. Family-owned and operated since 1997, Uncle Bub's is the real deal barbecue. A family-friendly restaurant open 7 days a week. Also, it's a full-service catering company doing weddings, pig roasts, luaus, grill packages, you name it. They have a friendly, helpful staff that will make sure that your party goes off without a hitch. Call them at 630-493-9000. Visit them at 132 South Cass Avenue in Westmount, Illinois, and UncleBubs.com. Hey man, I know you like grilling. I know you like getting those dark grill marks on your burgers, fish, chicken. And I know you don't want to just dry your meat out like you're cooking with a hairdryer. Why not get the Man Grate and click through the AndyDareShow.com's banner so we can keep the lights on here at Honeycomb Hideout Studios in gorgeous Westmont, Illinois. The Man Grate. This episode of the Andy Derer Show is brought to you in part by Record Utopia, a music lover's dream with thousands of vinyl records, musical instruments, and sound gear. They buy, sell, and trade. Give them a call at 630-963-1957. Visit them in Westmont, Illinois at 309 West Ogden Avenue, on the web at recordutopia.com. It's always a good, relaxed atmosphere. Check them out, Record Utopia. This has been a presentation of the Andy Derer Show and Derer Network. Copyright 2016. All rights reserved. Thank you so much for listening, and please do check out AndyDerer.com for more info.